Interview.
Welcome back to the 9-8 podcast, the home of everything progressive and underground right here in Australia. My name is Alex Hogg, and for this episode, I'm joined by Charlie Pallett of Ebon Ivory. If you'd heard the last episode that we did of the 9-8 podcast, you will have heard Dave and I go track by track on this record, and we had a lot of unanswered questions about this album. So we reached out to Ebon Ivory, see if they'd be willing to come onto the show. Lo and behold, they were pretty quick to respond to us to say, hey, you know, we're interested in coming on the show. So Charlie joined us for a really nice chat about the lyrics, about the themes for the record, and how they did the live stream, Live at Musicians Institute in Ballarat, which is a really good live stream if you're looking for live streams to watch while you're in this sort of COVID-19 situation. So Charlie, welcome to the 9-8 podcast.
Thank you very much. It's good to be here.
So you've mentioned that Ebon Ivory's sound is broadly mixing prog metal and punk, and you've mentioned growing up listening to Periphery and pop punk bands like Blink-182 and then moving on to modern prog. So what does prog mean to you? Because prog is such a broad church that encompasses so many different musical bands and stylings.
Prog to me is sort of like, it's all about sort of pushing those boundaries, you know, and experimenting and just trying to sort of come up with something that's fresh. And I know that a lot of prog, you know, prog sort of become, you know, a really defined genre, at least in progressive metal, where, you know, you tell someone, oh, I'm in a progressive metal band, and immediately everyone's thinking, oh, it's, you know, a Periphery clone or, you know, just some technical metalcore band. But to me, prog's really about sort of breaking away even from, you know, the tried and true prog. So yeah, it's really just about pushing the envelope and you know, trying to find something that's unique to yourself that people haven't heard before.
Oh, that's fair enough. I understand where you're coming from. You know, especially I see it now where you get some bands are coming through and you can hear that they are very much influenced by Carnival or Dream Theater or whatever. Yeah, and there's not too much of that mixing of different influences. Sort of right. Yep. We are influenced by Dream Theater and we want to make Dream Theater stuff.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
So you've been quoted in an interview recently saying that you don't necessarily listen to a large swathe of bands. Do you feel that this kind of lack of knowledge, I suppose, about lots and lots of different artists helps or hinders your creativity when approaching a song?
I think it definitely helps because not having, you know, this vast knowledge of, you know, everything that's going on in the world currently kind of forces you to take your own path when you're writing music. And you draw from, you know, things that you grew up on, things that are really dear to you rather than, you know, things that, you know, are trending now or, you know, things that you might not have as much interest in, but other people do. So it really forces the music to come from within and, you know, have a lot of different kind of influences all coming together into this one sort of cohesive sound rather than, you know, having your 10 favorite progressive metal bands and distilling a sound from that. You know, like one of my favorite bands, the Mars Volta, and, you know, we sound nothing like them, but a lot of their functionality, like, you know, extended interludes and playing around with just noisescapes and, you know, wacky sounds on guitar. You know, a lot of that influenced me about how, you know, music and audio and the production side of it can become, you know, part of the art. You know, all these little facets and functions of, you know, different genres, different artists sort of come together rather than trying to emulate, you know, a specific sound.
It's interesting that you came back with that answer because the other answer that I've heard as well is that when musicians sort of live, eat, sleep, breathe music 24/7, the last thing they want to do is sit around after they've finished working on music and listen to more music.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah, I mean, especially coming from, you know, I'm a composer and also I produce all of our music and producing music is one of my jobs. So it's kind of like whenever I'm listening to music, it's like, you know, my brain is just going crazy analyzing the music and it's also going crazy analyzing the production and it's like listening to music's very, very loud to me.
Yeah, fair enough. I totally understand where you're coming from. Mm. So let's talk about the new record that you've just recently released, The Long Dream One. Now, some of the things that we noticed when we were listening through to this record in our previous episode was the relentlessness of the music and the vivid description of some pretty dark subjects such as like struggles within the mind, feelings of regret and shame. Talk us through what led you to write a record like that.
It's sort of like, I mean, it's a record that's sort of been in the works for, you know, years and years. It's kind of just like all of the songs were written pretty far apart from one another, like lyrically. I'm really slow with writing lyrics. So a lot of it is sort of based around what I was going through at the time. And it's all sort of through the lens of 50 years time, you know, am I going to look back and think, did I live the right life? Could I have done something different? And I guess all of it is sort of coming to terms with, you know, things that have happened and things that have defined us, and ultimately just accepting, you know, whatever's happened has happened, and the best that you can do is, you know, move on to the next chapter of your life. So that, you know, in the end, when you're on your deathbed, you know, you can go in peace, essentially. And, you know, stop looking for that part of you that was lost. A lot of the songs, whenever the pronoun you is used, it's usually in reference to my past self, or, you know, a part of me that was taken or is missing or damaged. A lot of them kind of come off as like, they can come off as like, you know, angry at an ex-partner or something, or whatever. But in any time that the word you is used, it's actually me, which some people pick up on, which is good.
Yeah, we were wondering sort of whether it was about sort of you and another. We actually discussed this as part of the show, whether or not it was like you and another person, or you sort of fighting it amongst yourself with yourself about yourself.
Yeah, exactly.
So it's good to have that part of clarified. How central to the record is the marriage of that relentlessness of the music with such heavy topics lyrically?
It is kind of, I mean, the name of the band is Ebon Ivory, so it is all about, you know, contrast and unity. And so, yeah, so sometimes you've got these upbeat kind of songs, you know, really contrasted with, you know, really deep personal stories. And so that's probably one of the most important aspects of the music to me anyway. And that's pretty relevant in our last album, The Only Constant. Like it can come off as a really fun musical experience, but it's framed by these, you know, darker stories. And I feel like a lot of progressive metal lyrically can kind of aim too high, like, you know, talking about the universe and, you know, all these grand narratives and, you know, huge concepts and stuff. But sometimes there's just those personal emotional stories that are lacking from the genre. So that's sort of what I'm trying to bring in.
You're not the only one as well, actually. Earlier on last year, we were looking at Lepros's Pitfalls. I'm not sure if you've heard. Have you heard that record? You familiar with that one?
I've heard bits of it.
Yeah, it was quite similar lyrically as well. Talking, I know Solberg was talking about a very sort of dark, depressive time in his life, and that sort of, you know, informed the lyrics as well.
Yeah.
So I think it's starting to come back the other way now. I think instead of it being high function concepts, it's more moving back towards the personal sort of thing.
Yeah, which is awesome.
It is.
There's stories that people need to hear, especially, you know, in this day and age.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. So this is the first of a two-part concept record, if I've read that correctly. What can people, as much as you're willing to disclose on a podcast like this, what can people expect from the second part, and how far along into the writing recording process is that second part?
So the second album, or the second part of the album, is essentially, musically, most of it is already composed and recorded. I mean, a lot of it was originally going to be released as one, you know, 2 hour long album, but self-producing it and writing it all, you know, you just get so sick of, you know, not having music out there. So we made the decision to split it in two. So a lot of the second album songs are, they already exist. And a lot of them, you know, you could listen to and enjoy, but that being said, a lot of them are tied to the first album songs, like there's still a lot of melodic, you know, intertwining and lyrical references, and, you know, thematic tie-ins and stuff. I think the second one, probably a bit more emotional, a bit darker overall than the first one. The first one has a lot of, you know, fun, jumpy songs. And the second one is sort of a bit darker, a bit more, a bit angrier at times. It'll be sort of the same mishmash as the first one is. The first one is very, you know, it goes to a lot of places. And the second one is, yeah, looking to do the exact same thing, and go to a lot of, you know, different places, explore a lot of sounds that, you know, I've never really done before. So it'll be worth the wait, I think. I'm excited to get it out there.
When you say you're going to exploring different sounds, what do you mean by this? Sort of like more sort of down tempo, more quieter sort of things, or that?
Yeah,
or
I mean,
okay.
I feel like every song has its own sort of micro genre within it. Like Explosions After Dark has, you know, that electronic bass, and it's a bit like futuristic, and Hanma Street is very, you know, playful with the little melodic parts in it. And, you know, Persist is like a pop punk progressive hybrid. I feel like they all sort of have their own little sub genre. I like to write songs that you could describe to someone in one sentence and they have an understanding of, you know, what it's about musically. So every time I write a song, it stems from just a little idea like that. Like, oh, I want to write a pop punk sounding song in 7/16 time signature, you know, and that's how it all begins.
It's probably for the best as well that the record didn't come out as one sort of 2-hour long thing, because I think that would have been quite a slog to kind of get through. I know I saw that with Dream Theater's Astonishing, where it was like a 2-CD big long concept thing, and it was a quite the slog to kind of get through and digest as a fan and as a listener of music. So
and imagine listening to that on vinyl, you'd have, you know, 8 sides or something, and
something
you'd
like that,
swap it over so many times you wouldn't be able to sit down and enjoy it.
Yeah, that is the kind of thing. Going back, I went through a brief vinyl phase and went back to it. The novelty of having to get up every 20 minutes and change vinyl, change the side of the vinyl, wore off very quickly.
Yeah, definitely.
So in Ebon Ivory, you write and record all the music except for the drums, and you perform all the vocals. How often do you have words on a page to try and write music for, or do you have a musical idea and a type of mood that brings and then write lyrics to that?
So the music always comes first for me. Music and composition is my main, you know, that's what I love about music. That's the thing that I enjoy doing the most. And the lyrics always come second. Although sometimes when I'm writing the song, you know, I'm always humming along to it, you know, thinking, you know, what the hooks might be. And I always sing like complete gibberish, like you wouldn't understand, you know, but occasionally like a really profound or catchy line pops out and I'm like, oh, that's really good. Maybe, you know, I'll base the entire song around that and give that one line, you know, context somehow. And that's sort of how a lot of the lyric writing starts. But yeah, there is always sort of a mood to the songs as I'm writing them and, you know, a few little lyrical ideas floating about.
It's interesting that you say that you're sort of like humming along with the song when you're playing it or trying to write something. There's so many other bands I've heard do that. I remember hearing, I think it was Wherever I May Roam by Metallica. The entire song was done musically, and what you had over the top before any lyrics were written was James Hetfield sort of going da 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 da, literally like that. And then he got to the part, I think Wherever I May Roam, and then da 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 da. And that was the whole song. The whole song was just him going da 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 da. And then he wrote lyrics. And I've heard Neil Morse do something similar as well when he's writing his music.
I think a lot of people do that because it's sort of a way to, you know, let go, especially like if you're in your car by yourself and you've got, you know, no shame, and no one's judging you. You can just let loose and try things out. And that's sort of when, you know, when magic happens.
Yeah, absolutely. You mentioned the songwriting process wherein the guitars are done first or sort of recorded first with programmed drums, and then your drummer comes in and records, and then you do the vocals.
Yeah,
I've heard other drummers mention that knowing where the lyrics will be and roughly what they are can influence the drum part in support in supporting the vocals.
That's very true.
Does that happen? And or does the tracking of the drums go slightly differently?
Well, I guess, yeah, the vocals are usually done before we, or for some of the songs at least, before we do drums, sometimes after. But a lot of my vocal rhythms and stuff tie in with, like, the definite rhythm of, you know, the riff or the song. And usually the drums always, you know, follow the guitars, what the guitars and bass are playing. But I think especially live, there's some little things that Dave does definitely influenced by my lyrical rhythms or like Louis's, you know, guitar solo or something. When Louis does like a big run, Dave will play a fill in sync with it. So there's definitely a lot of crossplay, especially live. Yeah.
Yeah, I was going to say, and so crossplay and also as well, like, development of the parts.
The songs are never finished.
As the song has been,
they're always a work in progress.
Being played live.
Exactly.
You know, it's that old line, is it? You know, art. Yeah, art is never truly finished. It's merely taken away.
Yeah.
So you mentioned that you sort of program drums for when you're writing the guitars. You mentioned that you used to play drums and still drum. And so when you present those ideas to your drummer for the recording, how often is there like an interesting part on a drum machine demo that he'll go, oh, that's a really interesting sort of take on it from someone who is like not. How much does that sort of change or influence the drum parts?
Yeah, I guess, well, drums is the first instrument that I ever learned. And it's the instrument that I've probably sunk the most time into. So when I'm writing like these riffs and rhythms, and, you know, I've got, you know, an idea of how to like frame it within the drums. But a lot of the time, especially now with Dave in the band, and Dave is like, you know, the best drummer, like, not bragging, the best drummer that I've ever met in my life. I've sort of more just written skeletons of drum parts now, you know, where's the backbeat, you know, what are the cymbals doing? And then the rest of it, you know, Dave does his thing. And it's always, you know, incredible. But things like, okay, you know, I want the cymbals to start playing, you know, 3/4 over this part. Those kind of things. And, you know, I want the snare to be on 2/4, but then in this section, you know, just to be on beat 3 or something. Those kind of things we always try and keep, you know, they're essential to the feeling of the song and the composition of the song. But anything outside of that, you know, Dave will always be playing, you know, hats with his left foot all the time, you know, adding in all his ghost notes and little flourishes and all of the fills, you know, are Dave's doing. Unless it's like an iconic fill, like the hook of the song or something, then, you know, we'll try and keep that as simple or like, you know, as true to the original as possible.
Yeah, fair enough. And how much of that goes on with the other instruments as well, with guitars, and how much of that is sort of bedded in?
Guitars are kind of different. I mean, the guitar solos and a lot of the more complex lead lines, Louis does, and we usually have, you know, a session where we both sit down and, you know, we'll just listen to the song. You know, he'll whip out the guitar and we'll just start tracking, you know, just get him to improvise. And after, you know, 2 or 3 hours, we've sort of cut together this, like, you know, chopped up, weird sounding solo. And then we're like, okay, that's good. Now learn it all. So I leave a few gaps in the songs for the others to come in and, you know, make their mark, which is, yeah, important to the sound as well, especially with Connor on bass, always adding, you know, little fills and stuff that, you know, I couldn't be bothered, you know, thinking of. You know, I just sort of do the bare minimum sometimes, and, you know, the other guys help spice it up, which is good.
It's interesting to hear when, you know, I'm always interested in when bands are, when the songs are written ostensibly by one person in the band, how then you mix that sort of your vision with sort of their more, I guess, focused or sort of like their own individuality in bringing parts to the song. So how important are the video clips for some of the songs? It seems like some of the messages in the songs are a little ambiguous without them. Is that your intention?
Yeah, I mean, I guess the messages in the songs are always ambiguous, sort of by design. Sometimes they don't even make sense to me, you know, until they're finished and I've listened to it properly. So, yeah, sometimes the meaning comes after. But doing the music videos, especially Tales of Termina, that was a really interesting one to shoot. It's one of our only narrative-based videos. And, yeah, it definitely gives an interpretation of the lyrics. You know, it's sort of broad and abstract, but, you know, yeah, it's about how everything is, you know, kind of predetermined, and sometimes you've got to, you know, break free from, you know, the grind of everyday life. But yeah, music videos, I mean, especially from like a marketing point of view, music videos are, you know, your number one contact point for any, you know, fan or fan to be. So they're definitely important, because I feel like if you've put so much effort into, you know, writing and recording these songs, you know, you really need to do them justice with a music video to, you know, get everyone's attention and give them something to look at while they listen to it. It definitely helps with feeling the song a lot more. Like if you can see someone like thwacking that snare drum and hear it at the same time, it's like, it's almost like you're really there. So it definitely helps get the music across if you can see it being performed. In terms of art and stuff, sometimes they can take a back seat and they're more about, like, you know, being flashy and getting attention. But yeah, some of our older music videos, like Hanmer Street, where, you know, we hand drew, you know, the entire thing, which took a very long time.
I can imagine.
And that was sort of, that was sort of, it tied into the song because, you know, the song was about my childhood, and the animation side of it used to be, you know, one of my hobbies. That was my passion before music was. So it was a little, you know, callback to that. So, I mean, doing more artistic music videos, definitely something we want to do, you know, now that we've got this album out there and, you know, people seem to, you know who we are and stuff. We can kind of take a bit more time to think about what we're doing and think about, you know, doing something truly unique again.
Fair enough. I understand where you're coming from there. I wanted to have a quick discussion about the song on the record, Cats. Now, when we were listening through to the record in the last episode, we were really struggling trying to work out, what is this song about?
It's about an old relationship of mine, and Cats is a reference to Cats the musical.
I gotcha.
Which, yeah, it's not actually about, you know, cats, even though I have three cats at the moment. I'm a big cats person. But yeah, it's just about, yeah, an old relationship that, you know, I don't really like talking about that much. But it was definitely a defining moment in my life. Cats the musical, that was the last, we went and saw a production of Cats in our town. And that was, you know, that was one of the last times we ever spoke. And so it's probably one of my favorite songs on the album, if not my favorite. Same with everyone else in the band. They really, really like that song. You know, the sort of softer element of it is kind of the music that we all enjoy listening to the most. So if people enjoy that song, then there's there's definitely more of that to come.
Ah, oh, fantastic. That was one of the things when we were going through the record. We were, I don't know, maybe just because of our, myself and David's background in prog, we were sort of maybe expecting a little bit more light and shade in the record, but it seemed to, this one seemed to sort of push forward a bit more. So we actually wondered on the show, I wonder if the second one's going to be sort of more in the lighter musical direction than the first one.
Yeah, there's definitely a lot of like emotional melodies in the second one. I guess you'll wait and see.
Yeah, absolutely. So when I was listening to the record, I assumed incorrectly that someone else in the band was doing the sort of the growling vocals. But when I was watching the Live at Mechanics Institute stream that was up on YouTube, and I found out it's all you. Yep. You're doing all of those vocals. And you've mentioned before that you were self-taught as a vocalist. Now, as someone who doesn't sing, that seems like a really hard thing to do, to swap between doing clean and then the growling. Usually other bands kind of have one person doing all the clean stuff and one person doing all the growling stuff. How do you pull off that transition when you're doing that live?
I mean, obviously practice is a lot of it. The way that I learned how to growl, it kind of started out as like a joke. I'd do this, you know, really low growly voice that kind of just developed into, you know, it got stronger and stronger. And then I started getting into metal and heavy music, and all of a sudden I was doing these growls, and they, you know, had volume and, you know, sounded pretty legit, I guess. Yeah, the way that I growl, I'm not 100% sure on like the technical term for it, but it doesn't use my vocal folds at all, I'm pretty sure. There's no sort of note that comes out with it. When I'm growling, it doesn't degrade my voice at all. And they're sort of two completely different vocal functions, so it's kind of easy to swap between them, you know, within milliseconds. Whereas I imagine if you were, you know, screaming or growling using like Fry or something, where, you know, you're using your vocal folds, it could be a bit harder to go between them because they're quite similar.
Yeah, that's happened quite a few times with the vocalists. Some vocalists I know who used to do a lot of that growling stuff, they quickly found that the more they do of that, they lose some of the higher notes they could do because they're actively damaging parts of the vocal.
Yeah, exactly, exactly.
Before you go on stage, though, do you go through specific warm-ups and stuff? I mean, I went through a whole 15, 20 minutes of listening to James LaBrie once explaining the process by how which he keeps his voice in check when he's on tour. Do you have any sort of specific routines or workouts you do to keep that in check live?
Usually before a show, I do some like scales to warm up, some humming. Drink like heaps and heaps of water. But I try not to overdo it. Usually before I go on stage, it's just a quick check from, you know, the bottom to the top of my range and back down again. If it's all there, then I'm good to go basically. And then, you know, 20 minute break and then we're on stage and that's it really. I try not to overthink it. I think if you start to overthink, you know, oh, is my voice warmed up, am I gonna make it, am I gonna be able to do this show, then you start to doubt yourself, and if you doubt anything that you're doing, you know, it's not gonna work.
I think part of it as well, especially when you're talking about someone who's in such a high profile big name band, there are certain expectations that are required of you.
Definitely.
With James LaBrie, the poor bugger, he gets like you take a look at his Twitter you take a look at his Twitter feed after a show and see how many times he's getting absolutely slammed in the comments by people saying he can't sing, he can't do this, he's rubbish. Oh man, it's just awful.
But he's singing, you know, a 3-hour set every night of the year.
And you know all the high stuff, all the low stuff. Yeah, you know, that's what I tell people. It's exactly. Like, well, you know, you go and sing in a prog metal band for 30 years, then come back and we'll compare notes. I want to talk about that live stream specifically. I mean, how was that put together? Was that sort of recorded in one take from start to finish? I understand that you were quite heavily involved in sort of video production and sort of and that world. Walk us through that. Presumably that was a full day production.
So essentially we got to the venue and we set up and, you know, did the set up all the audio. It was 16 channels, and you know, had that all going. And then, you know, got all the cameras ready and whatnot. And then we just went through the album song by song, did a song, recorded it all, you know, yep, okay, it's all good. On to the next one. And, you know, if something catastrophic went wrong, we'd just stop and, you know, we'd do that song again. But we tried to do it just for the sake of keeping the editing as easy as possible. We'd do it in like groups of two songs. So we'd do the intro and then Hanma Street as, you know, one big long clip so that I didn't have to, you know, sync up 13 different takes, you know, of the songs. A lot of the songs were done in chunks of, you know, two or three. And then, yeah, when it was all done, just edit it all together, mix it, you know, try and get it sounding as clear as possible. That was one of the reasons that we decided not to like truly live stream it, is because, you know, how do we check how it sounds? How do we level out, you know, oh, this guitar part was a little bit too loud and it's, you know, really annoying to the ears. So we needed a little bit of control audio wise, especially, you know, with a small production like that. You don't really want to just wing it, especially when you're taking so much time to produce it. You know, you want it to be the best that it can be.
That's definitely happening a lot as this sort of COVID-19 situation continues to develop. That's happening a lot more. I mean, I see there was a festival, I think it was the Melbourne Guitar Festival or something. It was a quote-unquote live stream on the internet, but what it really was just a series of videos that people had done, and they sort of stitched them all together and then sort of pushed play as like a live stream in big air quotes. Live streaming in that sense of like actually going live is fine if it's sort of like one person or maybe two people in their house with a piano and or guitar.
When you're trying to do full band music,
When you're trying to do full band productions, that's where you need them. So for those out there listening who maybe want to do some live streaming or some filming of their own, what tips would you give to the musicians out there listening to the show?
Invest in a decent camera. I mean, if you're a musician, you should have a camera. Cameras are extremely vital to any music career. Almost, dare I say it, more important than, you know, good recording gear and good instruments, because if you can make your content look incredible and, you know, at a professional standard, and you learn how to operate a camera and, you know, edit, you know, footage and whatnot, then you will look like you're, you know, leagues ahead of everyone else in, you know, in your peer group. And that can definitely give you an edge and, you know, attract more people to your band and your content, and your live stream. If you're streaming, you know, get a webcam or get, you know, a DSLR or a mirrorless camera and, you know, a capture card, a HDMI to USB or something, and use that as your webcam, which is, you know, the best thing that you can do. I'd say if you're going to live stream, make sure that it looks as good as possible. I know a lot of new, like, iPhones and stuff have, you know, extremely good cameras on them. So just sort of not underestimating the impact of the visual aspect to it, I guess. Obviously, you know, having a good microphone is also a good idea. But there aren't many people that just want to watch, you know, someone, you know, at their piano with their Nokia brick phone camera, and, you know, clipping audio. You know, they might be the best musician in the world and have the most amazing voice, but it's not really going to translate, digitally if you don't have the right equipment and the right know-how. So yeah, just invest, I guess. It'll pay off.
Absolutely. What sort of cameras, is there a specific camera brand or type that you would, you know, I know you mentioned mirrorless cameras. And forgive me, I'm no photographer, but my wife sort of kind of is. So I'm vaguely aware of some of the terms that are used here. So what would you suggest people start with something that's relatively inexpensive, but will still give the quality that people,
yeah, yeah,
people want to see.
Personally, I use Sony cameras. They're amazing. I use the A7S and the A7S II, which are like just video beasts. But Sony have a lot of like entry level mirrorless cameras, like the A6600, I think they call it, not 6000. A6600 is like dirt cheap. You can get one of them with a lens for, you know, maybe $300 or $400 Australian. And they take really great photos and they can do video. Although they don't, those ones don't have an external microphone input, but I think the 6100 or the 6300 or something has a mic input. And, you know, if you've got an external, I use Rode video mics, then, you know, you can plug that in and all your audio is going to be straight in the video file. You know, it's less hassle. You don't have to worry about syncing up audio and video. So yeah, yeah, definitely from experience, the lower end Sony, their APS-C size sensors or their full frame sensors like the A7 are all, you know, very, very high quality. Sometimes they're a bit weird, like with the menus, knowing where everything is. But if you get your head around that, you're in for a good time.
It's interesting how photographers sort of get stuck in like fiefdoms of different cameras. Like my wife, for example, is a big Fujifilm user, yeah, and has all their, yeah, stuff. And I know other people are into, a friend of mine does like star photography with Canon and things like that. It's,
yeah,
interesting.
Yeah.
Sort of kind of like how people with their computers, they kind of get stuck in like PC or Mac land. Like,
yeah, yeah.
Photographers going to get stuck in the sort, yeah, of camera fiefdoms, yeah, I suppose. When, yeah, we spoke I'm sorry, go on.
Oh, I was just going to say, it's funny. I've got a MacBook and a Windows PC open in front of me.
So, how do you go about swapping between the two? That's always a fun one.
It's I always find myself when I'm using Pro Tools on my PC, using Alt, you know, Alt S for save or Alt, you know, something instead of Control, because the Command button on the Mac is where the Alt button is. But, you know, I haven't accidentally deleted an entire session yet, so it's fine, I think. Yeah.
When we spoke to Dan Fenari from Polaris a couple of weeks ago, he thought that live streaming, as it has developed as a concept during this COVID-19 situation, would be untenable going forward long-term out of a lockdown. Now, would you consider, with your band, doing some sort of live stream performance like this again, and where do you see it fitting into the future of live performances after we're out of a lockdown situation?
I think like as sort of music becomes more accessible globally, like, you know, we're an Australian band, but we have fans, you know, all over the world. Now that everyone's sort of proven that, you know, live streaming is like a valid delivery format for music and performance, I think we'll be seeing, you know, a lot more of it as a way to sort of bring, you know, the global fan base together, rather than, you know, you have to do a world tour and it costs, you know, $1 million or whatever. I think that now that people kind of take live streaming and recorded performances sort of seriously, I don't think they're going anywhere. I think that, you know, more and more bands will get on board with it, I guess. And, I mean, consumers seem to enjoy it. So I think it's a win-win for everyone. It definitely lowers the, for, like, new bands especially, the barrier of entry. You know, maybe they haven't played live much before and they're, you know, too nervous to get, you know, book a gig somewhere. They can always record a performance or live stream it. And there's, you know, no costs involved. And, you know, everyone can give it a crack, basically.
Be interesting if it almost is like a portfolio piece to then approach other saying, well, hey, well, this is what we sound like. This is what we look like performing,
yeah,
live.
Yeah.
How about put us on for a show? Because we all know how hard it is to try and book shows,
yeah,
and,
yeah,
get shows up and running in this country, especially in,
yeah, exactly,
in New South Wales. I mean, yeah, that's just, ugh. Speaking of the music scenes, I mean, tell us about the Ballarat music scene. What's going on out there? Is there a sort of a thriving metal and punk scene, or what's happening out there?
When I was in high school, there was like a huge metal scene. It was amazing. There were gigs, you know, all the time. And then sort of as time went on, you know, there were less and less bands, I guess. You know, bands would break up because, you know, they felt like they weren't achieving what they wanted to. There's always been like an indie rock scene, and that's going pretty strong at the moment. But in terms of metal, there hasn't really been too much going on. And, you know, one of our venues, Corova Lounge, had to shut its doors. So there is a scene, but it's not what it used to be. And I think that's a trend that, you know, every rural town has sort of struggled with, like, you know, Bendigo and, you know, all the other Victorian towns sort of, it dwindles, I guess. But at the same time, you know, bands can reach a wider audience online, which is, you know, it's a silver lining, I guess.
I guess there's sort of two parts to that I'm thinking of, is that maybe at a certain point people feel like when they're living in Ballarat or Bendigo, they have to move to Melbourne to kind of stuff, even not even necessarily in a musical setting, just in a non-musical setting, to kind of let you get a job or something, maybe the better opportunities in the bigger cities. But the other part of it as well is, like, you know, I'm based here in Perth, and sometimes that isolation from a really big music scene can sometimes create some incredibly creative music. You know, people who aren't necessarily interested in chasing the big whatever.
Yeah, yeah, the big cheese.
Yeah, exactly. Just the, you know, even a big popular success of music. They just want to create the music that they want, and that creates some more interesting and diverse sounds.
Yeah, definitely.
So I have one last question for you, and this is a question that we tend to ask at the end of all of our interviews. What's one topic that you wished you were asked about in interviews but aren't?
Probably what my favorite food is, or just, you know, something personal, I guess. A lot of it's just about, you know, the music and, you know, the performance and stuff. But I guess sometimes it's nice to just talk about, you know, what's going on.
Now you've opened the door. What is your favorite food? What sort of stuff do you like to cook at home or have at home?
That's a great question. I'm glad you are. At the moment, I'm really into gnocchi, just like gnocchi with I use Nutellex instead of butter, but like a burnt Nutellex and sage sauce with, you know, some herbs and spices, and you know, fry the gnocchi till it's a bit crunchy. That's my staple at the moment. You know, it's a 5-minute meal, and it's delicious and cheap.
Excellent. Sounds good. I've got my mouth watering already. There's one other question that I would like to ask as well. Going forward, playing live, if you were contractually obligated to perform one song of yours or even by another band for the rest of your career, which one would you pick and why?
For our songs, I'd probably pick Silent Sirens from our first album. It's the most fun to sing and perform live, and it's just got a good vibe, and it's just my favorite Ebon Ivory song, I guess, live at least. Silent Sirens, I think, would be the song of mine.
Fair enough. All right, then. So I think that about wraps it up for the interview here on the 9-8 podcast. Thank you very much for joining me.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
So that about wraps it up this week on the 9-8 podcast. If you'd like to find the links in the show notes for this episode, you can find them at the 9-8podcast.fireside.fm/IV8. You can find us on Twitter at 98FM. And if you'd like to send us any feedback for this show, you can find a contact form on our website at the98podcast.fireside.fm. Until next time, my name is Alex Hogg, and we shall see you all next time. The 9-8 interview.